Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Davis Brown, an assistant professor of political science at Maryville University in St. Louis. Davis is the author of The Sword, the Cross, and the Eagle, the American Christian Just War Tradition, which was published in 2008, and he is the co-editor of The Just War Tradition, Applying Old Ethics to New Problems, which came out last year. We always have links to our guest books for your perusal over at our website, so please venture over there and check them out. Davis has also penned a number of articles and book chapters on the topic of religion and conflict, as well as putting together a brand new data set entitled Religious Characteristics of States that will be housed at the Association of Religion Data Archives, or the ARDA, over yonder at Penn State University and managed by our good friends Roger Finke and Chris Bader. Prior to his academic career, Davis earned a law degree from New York University and a master's in international law from George Washington University's Law School. He has served as a lawyer in the U.S. Air Force and in private practice, giving him a very unique and interesting perspective on what will be the topic of discussion today, which is just war theory. But before that, folks, don't forget that we are on Facebook and Twitter, and we would love to have you sign up for regular updates regarding our show. We don't post many pictures of kittens unless it's absolutely necessary, so please stop by, sign up for us on Twitter. We'd love to have you over there. Davis, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here.
Now, you are the first Judge Advocate General, or JAG, which is the fancy abbreviated term for military lawyer person, that I've ever had on the show. And I remember Tom Cruise in the movie A Few Good Men, and I'm thinking that this is probably what your career must have been like, being a military lawyer. So tell us a little bit about that career and what you did, and be truthful about it.
Okay, well, my immediate response is you can't handle the truth. Actually, my military career was more like the TV show JAG, with the Navy JAG Harm, who, yeah, I did everything he did. I flew helicopters, and I traveled all around the world capturing terrorists and other bad guys, and even went into outer space and everything.
That's
what JAGs do.
Yeah, I'm sure that's on the brochure hanging on the bulletin boards at schools. You know, come be a military lawyer, fly in outer space, conquer terrorists on the moon, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, what does a JAG do?
Okay, well, seriously, a JAG has two primary responsibilities. And one is to handle the criminal stuff, to prosecute infractions, crimes, and other military offenses. We are the prosecutors and defense counsel, court-martial system as a whole, an entire legal system with, by the way, all of the same rights and protections of the accused that civilians have. But also, the function of the JAG is to be the legal advisor to military commanders, all the way up the chain of command. So we are constantly giving advice to our commanders on how to comply with the law, because if we don't comply with the law, we get in trouble. Everybody gets in trouble. And this is as much true for military operations as it is for the many other aspects of law that JAGdom touches, contract law, labor law, tort law, you name it.
That's really fascinating, because our typical vision here as civilians of how a war is conducted is that some general says, well, I'm going to invade this target. They pick up the red phone, call out the jet, and boom, it happens right away. But they have to run a lot of their decisions past you. So you must have been called into some rooms and they said, okay, we have plan X, plan Y, and plan Z. How does this fit into things? And that must also have slowed down the process a little bit.
Well, it can slow down the process, but a well-trained JAG can do these kinds of reviews fairly quickly when the urgency of getting to that target quickly is there. And yes, I did do a little bit of that. Some of it was classified. Mainly my experience was doing this kind of target review during Operation Desert Fox. This was the military operation against Iraq that took place in December of 1998. I was deployed in Saudi Arabia at the time. We really do review targets and the circumstances and surroundings of those targets and offer an opinion as to whether jus in bello, that is the law of armed conflict, has been complied with or not. And this is really important because if we don't comply with the law of armed conflict, then not only have we violated international law, but the officers and airmen and JAGs, for that matter, have also violated U.S. law. So it's a big deal.
It is a big deal, and that's something that we're going to talk about here in a little bit, the jus in bello and how international law dovetails with U.S. law as well. But I have one more career question for you, and that is, how did you get involved in studying religion, military conflict, and just war theory over at the University of Virginia, where you earned your Ph.D.? It seems that, you know, being a JAG sounds like a pretty cool life, going into outer space and all. Why head out into the world of academia?
Well, I discovered that I really wanted to be an academic, and so as such, I was researching, writing on a number of questions of international law. I had, from law school, always been interested in the international law of military conflict, and I began to discover that international law was not able to answer the kinds of questions that I was asking. And by then, I was no longer asking questions of jus in bello. I was asking questions of jus ad bellum, the justification of military conflict, military force. At first, through the lens of humanitarian intervention, broadening my question into the justification of war in general. That's what got me into the domain of just war theory and religion at the same time, because as we will discover, just war theory has its roots in religion. So at the same time I was discovering one, I was discovering the other.
And you trained over there at the University of Virginia underneath one of our former guests, John Owen. So you got a great education in terms of doing that. And you mentioned two terms here. You mentioned jus in bello and jus ad bello. And I assume jus in bello is the proper use of military force, right, in war. But jus ad bello is the proper entering of war, or whether you should go to war or not.
That is right. The way I would have put it is ad bellum speaks to the justification of using military force to get your way in the first place. And in bello speaks to the proper methods and means of warfare once it is entered into.
Okay, so those are a couple Latin terms there that we're going to be hearing a lot about as we move into talking about just war theory. So let's go ahead and do that. Now, I would assume that you, as well as myself and most of our listeners, think that war is a bad thing and that less of it in the world would be something that we want to strive for. However, we probably also realize that throughout human history, conflict between people, tribes, and nation states, that's pretty common. And in fact, there's not a year that goes by that there isn't some sort of fighting between at least two societies out there. And as such, war, that's been on our minds of regular civilians and great thinkers throughout history in terms of finding ways to avoid it, or when it does seem inevitable, for justifying the use of war. Give us a brief history of what might be loosely called theories of justifying war.
Okay. Well, first of all, you are absolutely right in that even just war theory is premised on the idea that war is undesirable and that it should be limited somehow. So just war theory, although it has a variety of secular applications, originates in Christianity. Now, this is kind of a hard thing to swallow for some people, because you know, Jesus is known as a pacifist, all about peace, telling Peter to put away the sword, for those who live by the sword will die by the sword, etc. But when you look really hard at the New Testament, we find that Jesus has very little to say about statecraft. Most of his preachings and all of his pacifist preachings are to a different kind of people, the disenfranchised, the poor, those who have no say in statecraft. And so Jesus is mostly talking to people about how to live out their daily lives. And although Jesus has very little to say about statecraft and nothing to say about war, the Apostle Paul does have something to say about it. So the biblical root of just war theory is actually in the book of Romans, and it originates in a passage by St. Paul. It's in Romans 13, verses 1 through 7, where he talks about the relationship of the people to the state, and part of the responsibility of the state is to protect the people. Paul is specifically speaking to protect the people from threats from within the state, like threats from crime and rioting and that kind of stuff. But it was a short step for later thinkers of the Catholic Church to extend that to the duty of the state to protect people from threats from the outside. And where just war theory comes in is by the end of the 3rd century A.D., 3rd century C.E., Christianity is in a position of political power in the Roman Empire. The Roman emperors are mostly Christian themselves at this point, and they need a way to reconcile Christianity to the need of the state to defend itself from attack, in this case from the Visigoths from the north. So around the end of the third century, Augustine, later a doctor of the Catholic Church, began to craft a bare-bones, disorganized just war theory. He wasn't the first, but he really clarified a lot of earlier thinking in a way that had not been done before.
So what does Augustine bring to the table? He starts to organize the thoughts of this, and Augustine is stomping around in the early to mid part of the 3rd century, if I'm correct.
Late 3rd century, early 4th century.
Ah, okay.
395 to about 405, 415, 420.
Okay.
Yeah. So what Augustine brings to this is the realization that sometimes war is necessary, but it is not a happy thing. That the perfect warrior is zealous in the need to fight the war and win, but do so honorably, but is also contrite, is regretful that that some situation requires him to do violence in the first place. War to Augustine is not about honor or glory or victory or self-enrichment at all. It is essentially to procure justice, to vindicate a right. And that is the tradition that Thomas Aquinas, another doctor of the Catholic Church, seizes upon in the late 1200s with his Summa Theologica.
So let's go into Aquinas, because he is the big looming figure here in just war theory. I'm sure many other people were talking about it throughout the centuries, but Aquinas is always the go-to guy in terms of starting to talk about just war theory. So what does he add to all of this?
He is. Thomas Aquinas draws from works of Augustine to organize Augustine's thoughts into three essential criteria for a war being just. And Thomas Aquinas was good at this. He organized Christian thought very well in a myriad of topics, including war. But it was Aquinas who really crystallized just war thinking into its current form. Many people call him the father of just war theory because his three criteria are so very elegant and simple. I would today actually characterize him as the grandfather of modern just war theory, for reasons that we'll probably talk about later in this show.
So go ahead and give us an idea what these three criteria are. They're pretty simple, and he's good at making points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So let's do the 1, 2, 3s of just war theory here.
Okay, and it really is just 1, 2, 3. Thomas Aquinas writes that in order for a war to be just, three criteria have to be met. And that means that all three of them have to be met, or otherwise the war is not just. First of all, number one, is that the war be undertaken by a proper authority. What this means is that military force be undertaken under the authority of what Aquinas called a prince. Today, if he were writing today, he would say under the authority of a state. And this is the thing that distinguishes acts of war, lawful in international law, from acts of violence by brigands or rioters, or in modern terms, terrorists or individuals acting on their own behalf. The war must be undertaken by agents of a state. And the reason this is so important, especially today, is that it makes an enormous difference in how the warriors themselves are supposed to be treated if they are captured. So that's proper authority. Aquinas's second criterion is just cause. In Aquinas's words, those who are attacked deserve to be attacked on account of some fault. That is, there has to be some kind of wrong committed against the party that is now going to war over that wrong. That's the second criterion.
And that would be jus ad bellum, right?
Yeah. Well, this is all jus ad bellum.
Ah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
The third criterion, according to Aquinas, is right intent, that the purpose of the war effort must be to advance good or to avoid evil. And this is often viewed in reverse. For example, an example of wrong intent would be going to war because you happen to have the excuse for it, because the other party has committed some kind of wrong against you, and going to war really just to capture more territory, or because because one country just so dislikes the other that it wants to annihilate it. Well, that's not an example of right intent. Right intent means you go to war for the limited purpose of rectifying the wrong that has been committed.
So he's trying to limit post hoc reasoning here and excuse making, I would guess.
Yes, he is.
Okay. I want to go back to that proper authority one, and that's interesting. And we'll get to it a little bit later. We're going to talk about a few case studies. But that is an interesting criteria for today's world, as you mentioned, because the war on terrorism often fights stateless entities. And you mentioned that the proper authority has to deal with how you treat enemy combatants. And today in modern law, there's the Geneva Convention where enemy combatant who is adhering to the Geneva Convention, they're in proper uniform, identified, et cetera, gets treated XYZ. But it must be somewhat difficult to do this for folks who don't wear the uniform, who are not part of a recognized state or even a recognized army, but are somewhat of a loose-knit terrorist organization. How is that thought developed, Aquinas' thought developed amongst just war theorists?
Okay. Actually, I would take the position that it's not the introduction of terrorist organizations that has complicated just war theory. Rather, the application of proper authority in just war theory simplifies the problem of how to treat these terrorist organizations. By the way, Jus in Bello makes provisions for irregular combatants makes provisions for the treatment of irregular combatants provided that they assume kind of the trappings of a state, uniforms and complying themselves with the law of armed conflict and that kind of thing. But this is not something that terrorist organizations do unless they are agents of state-sponsored terrorism. From a just war theory perspective, it is pretty clear, to me at least, that terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, because it is not recognized as a state, they do not wage military conflict with proper authority, and therefore if they are captured, even if their cause and intent were just, they are still not lawful combatants, so their actions are by definition unjust, but also they are unlawful combatants, and therefore they are not entitled to the same kind of treatment that the prisoners of war that are lawful combatants would be given.
Now, the reason I bring this up is because Aquinas, writing almost a millennium ago, not quite that, but 800 or so years ago, must have been experiencing a different kind of warfare. Much more of it was sponsored by what essentially would be called states, loose-knit states in medieval time, princes and barons and kings and the like. And so didn't really anticipate this form of irregular combat, or was there some inkling that, there might be some kind of, tribes running around and, smashing things and breaking things up? Did he have any inkling of that?
Well, he must have anticipated some of that, because if he did not anticipate the problem of proper authority, I don't think he would have brought it up. And that's his number one criterion. Even superior to just cause. But my sense is that in the 13th century, there were starting to groups opposing the authority of the Catholic Church were starting to crop up, and it could be that Aquinas was anticipating some of these groups maybe being militarized. If that is the case, then he turned out to be quite prophetic, because that did happen in a big way during the Reformation.
It'd be interesting to follow some kind of research strategy that examines that possibility in there. I don't know if anybody has done that before, but it poses a very interesting question. So Aquinas wrote this stuff in the 1200s. And the world keeps changing. New things start happening, as you just mentioned. There's more challenges to the Catholic Church, eventually culminating in the Reformation. States are starting to coagulate, move around, form more strict boundaries. How does just war theory evolve, and who are some of the major players in this evolution?
Okay. Well, the major players include a couple of Spanish Jesuit priests, one writing in the early 1500s and another writing in the early 1600s. A major player in the development of just war theory also is Hugo Grotius, who wrote in the early 1600s and is known as the father of international law today. But there's one particular person that I want to focus on. His name was Francisco Suarez. Suarez was a Spanish Jesuit priest, and Suarez did a little piece called On War, published it in, I believe, 1612. And Suarez tweaks Aquinas' just war criteria a little bit. He keeps proper authority and just cause, but Suarez also makes the point, is the beginning of the making of the point that Aquinas' second criterion, just cause, is actually two criteria. One is just cause, that those who are attacked deserve to be attacked on account of some fault, where we're focused on the fault, the wrong or the injury done to the party that ultimately goes to war over it. But just cause can be read in a different light, that those who are attacked deserve to be attacked on account of some fault. And that that introduces the criterion of proportionality, the idea that whatever the wrong is, it has to be big enough to warrant the drastic and messy solution of war. So that is one of the first, that is one major development that was introduced by Suarez's reinterpretation of just war theory. The other way that Suarez really made a sea change in just war thinking is that instead of speaking of right intent, Suarez spoke of right manner. That the war should be conducted in a just generally in a proper way, and he fleshes this out in his tractate on war. And from that fleshing out flow a number of additional criteria that have been added to the just war calculus. So just war theory has not just three criteria today, though Thomas Aquinas' three are easily the most important, but there are a number of ancillary criteria as well, proportionality being one, and here are a few other, all of which flow from Suarez. Reasonable prospect of success. This is the idea that if you're going to undertake war, you need to do it for an objective that is actually achievable. If there's no hope in achieving your objective, then all you're doing is inflicting more suffering on your own people and other people's, so the war is not worth it. A second one introduced through Suarez is the criterion of last resort, that war should be only should be undertaken only when all other reasonable alternatives are exhausted. And the last one is just means. And this is where jus in bello comes back into the mix. Because if your cause is just, then if you fight the war using entirely unjust means, then the use of those unjust means undermines your claim that your war effort is justified in the first place.
Okay, so he adds a bunch of these things. He starts to separate the cause from the actual persecution of the war itself. I can see that starting to differentiate itself. I want to return back to this idea of proportionality, though, and you said something that's very interesting and it must be difficult to wrangle with in international law terms. But you had mentioned that those who are being attacked deserve to be attacked for some fault. And that is left, I've seen this in the writing as well, they say some fault. Well, what does some fault mean? I mean, I know I'm kind of loud and obnoxious sometimes, and is that a fault for somebody to go out and attack me? Or is there some criteria to determine what a fault is and what is proportion, you know, a proportional attack to that?
Okay, fair question. So, let me answer the question specifically toward your being loud and obnoxious. If you were ever loud and obnoxious, say in a diplomatic setting where there is the, you know, unwritten rule or unspoken duty that all diplomats are supposed to respect each other, if you violate that rule, then you may have committed a fault. But who have you harmed, really? You haven't really harmed anybody. You maybe hurt somebody's pride, but wounding somebody's pride, I think most people would say is not a big enough deal to kill people and break things over. And so that is a simplistic, I suppose, application of the rule of proportionality. And if you look at all the literature on just war theory and how just war theory is used to claim a justification of this war or claim that that war is not justified, the hardest criterion really is proportionality. It's the one criterion that that I submit has really not been looked at enough and studied enough. And yet it's the hardest one, and I would like to, for my part, I'd like to see more literature devoted to that particular problem.
I can see why a lot of people avoid it. It seems really to be messy, and I can imagine that there are some cultural considerations about proportionality that come into play. You know, what does it mean to be doing harm to somebody else? If you're repressing a certain portion of your population, a certain demographic group, or women, or whatever it might be, some people might say, "Wow, that really is a cause to go to war." But other people say, "No, that's just their cultural context," and so it'd be hard to apply proportionality there, would it not?
It is. It is hard to apply. It is very difficult to apply, partly because of this problem. What one party may consider a wrong, legal or moral or otherwise, some other party may really legitimately not consider to be a wrong. And this is why just war theory is not so much a standard for justifying war as it is a framework for evaluating the justice of war, because two different people can look at the same facts surrounding a particular war and apply just war theory, and one can find it justified and the other can find it not justified. And the difference usually comes down to, one, whether there is a just cause, and that can be as much cultural as it can be a legal question. But also, different people may have different opinions on whether the cause is bad enough to warrant military force. And all kinds of personality traits and ideologies and experiences come into play when one is evaluating questions like this.
So I want to explore the topic of proportionality a little bit more, because that is where you are putting your footprint in the academic literature, having written some very interesting pieces on this. But we left off in the 16th century with Francisco Juarez, or was it the 1600s? Was he?
1600, 1612, Francisco Suarez with an S.
So 17th century. I'm sure there's been a few more developments in just war theory since then, because since that time, the number of academics have increased exponentially, and I'm sure we have a lot to say about that. So fill us in a little bit from the 17th century to roughly today of any other major developments in just war theory before we dive into proportionality.
Sure. Okay, so after Suarez and Grotius, just war theory doesn't really change much. In fact, its application starts to decline, especially in the 18th century with the age of absolutism, and really in IR terms, kind of the age of realism. With the advent of positive international law, where international law is going to, the content of international law is going to be what states themselves determine it to be, states realize in the 1700s that they don't necessarily want to be constrained by just war theory in international law. So states essentially abandon it, and the legal scholars that are tracking the development of international law also kind of abandon it too. So just war theory falls into desuetude in the 18th and especially the 19th centuries. And it isn't until World War I, war to end all wars, the big one at that point in history, that scholars start to reconsider their abandonment of just war theory. And in the United States, I would say that just war theory began to be reclaimed during the time of World War II, and especially in the 1960s with the work of Paul Ramsey and his book War and Christian Conscience. Wildly successful book, though it's a religious studies book, not a political science book. But Ramsey's work led to renewed scholarly interest in just war theory, and I would say after Ramsey, the two most prominent scholars in just war theory in this country have turned out to be one, James Turner Johnson, who writes on just war theory from the Christian perspective, though he introduces a lot of secular thought into it as well. And secondly, Michael Walzer, whose book Just and Unjust Wars was a classic, very much a secular variant of just war theory. Neither of them are redefining just war theory. Neither of them are so much adding to it as Suarez did, but they are using just war theory as a framework to tackle contemporary questions, questions relating to justifications of contemporary wars.
And that's where you come in. You're a contemporary author, and you recently wrote an article called Proportionality in Modern Just War Theory, a Tort-Based Approach. And that is a really interesting article. First of all, we're going to go back here to talk about that sticky issue of proportionality, but you add in this whole issue of tort-based approach. And when I think of tort based approaches, I'm thinking of somebody suing in court that I found a rat in my bucket of chicken and it caused me psychological damage and you owe me a couple million dollars. So explain how you come at this issue of proportionality and bring in the issue of tort law, especially in the context of international law. That seems to be bringing a lot of different ingredients into this big pot.
Yes, it does. Well, let's start with the analogy of the rat in the soup. In English common law, which forms the basis of American law, for a tort claim to be successful, several legal criteria have to be satisfied: duty, breach, causation, and damages. That is, one party must have a legal duty toward another party, and the first party has to have breached that duty. In the case of the rat in the soup, the kitchen, the restaurant, the chef, they all have a legal duty to ensure the safety of the food that they are preparing. By allowing a rat to get into the soup, they have breached that duty toward the customer. The criterion of causation comes in to this in that we can infer that but for the chef's carelessness in the kitchen, but for the chef being inattentive to the pot and what's going into the pot, this rat got in there. And had the chef been attentive, then the chef could have caught the rat before it got into the soup. So we have duty breach causation, and then the soup reaches the customer, and the customer maybe has tasted it, so has gotten the germs from it, or even if the customer has not tasted it, the customer has seen the rat and just had a fit of horror in the middle of the restaurant. So the customer has maybe incurred some physical injury through disease, definitely some mental and emotional trauma, and those are the customer's damages. Duty, breach, causation, damages. Well, let's bring this to international law and jus ad bellum in particular. International law has this idea of countermeasures, where if one state breaches a duty toward another state and does harm to that other state, then the other state may take remedial measures. Now, the modern law of countermeasures does not provide for military force to remediate these measures, but I have taken the position that in natural law, in classical international law of countermeasures, if the injury were big enough, then so should be the remedy. And so maybe there are cases where a legal injury really is big enough to justify the drastic and messy solution of war. And so here is a big one for you. The duty of a state not to invade another state. And all states have that legal duty today. It's in the UN Charter and in customary international law and everything. When a state invades another state, it has breached its duty not to invade other states. And the causation then is understood and the damages are understood. So surely there must be a right of the victim state to procure a remedy. Well, that right has a different name in international law today. It's called the inherent right of self-defense. But in the end, in my opinion, jus ad bellum, as well as many other kinds of law, ultimately come down to this formula of duty, breach, causation, damages, remediation.
So the invasion of one state of another seems pretty clear-cut. And we're going to talk about a few examples here in a little bit. But I can imagine that it gets a little bit murky here and there. As you were talking about this, I was just thinking about the People's Republic of China building a new island in the South China Sea to expand their territorial waters. That probably gets a little bit fuzzy in terms of this whole duty breach, causation, and damages thing.
It does. It does. So in a case like that, and this is not one that I've followed or really studied well, but from a tort-based framework, our first question would be, has China violated any rule of international law in building this island? And if it has, Then we have at least passed the first gate or the first step in determining whether some kind of a military force to stop this to stop this so-called incursion would be justified or not. But if in international law China is perfectly free to build an island and to claim that island as its own territory, as any other state that might build an island would be wont to do, and protect that island and establish territorial waters and all that, if all of that is permitted in international law, then we may have a more difficult time determining whether China had a duty, whether China had a duty to other states and breached that duty. And if we can't find a breach, then we cannot find a just cause in Aquinas' terms.
Now, who is all determining this? You talk about international law, and you mentioned the United Nations a little bit earlier. And I tend to be one of these realist thinkers if I put myself into the international relations perspective. I guess I'm an old guy that goes back to the 18th century. The UN has seemed to be the arbitrator of this. You go to the UN and say, hey, international law violated here, please pass judgment on this. But, you know, the United Nations is you know, a little bit iffy on in terms of making these judgments, and do they really have any kind of authority? So I guess my bigger question here is, who makes these decisions of whether or not a country is in violation of international law for building an island somewhere?
Right. Well, in a perfect world, there would be a supreme government of the world making these kinds of, well, if there were a supreme government of the world, then the whole spectrum of war and conflict would be very different. In a perfect world, in just war terms, there would be a supreme court or official or somebody determining, you know, making these determinations, and these determinations would have force of law. We don't live in that kind of world. And you're right to be skeptical of the ability of the UN to make these kinds of judgments and for these judgments to be binding legally or morally. And here's the reason. The UN is, first of all, in the General Assembly, often driven by a herd mentality. I've seen it myself, being a delegate to the Special Working Group on the Crime of Aggression. People come up with an idea, and lots of people decide, you know, lots of other states decide they're going to follow it, and they haven't really thought it through well on their own. And in the politics of the UN, some states are more popular than others, and some states are considerably less popular than others. I don't think I even have to name names.
This sounds like junior high school.
I hate to say this, but in a way, it kind of is.
Yeah. Yeah, herd mentality, the popular clique, the unpopular clique. Yeah,
yes,
I lived through that.
And the unpopular states always, they always get the short shrift. They never get the benefit of the doubt, which is like in junior high. But here's the other problem in the UN, and this goes to one way in which just war theory is often misinterpreted today. In international law, not just war theory, but in international law, according to the plain meaning of the text of international law, the final arbiter on the legal permissibility of using force is the Security Council of the United Nations. Well, the Security Council is more a political body than a legal body. Two of its five permanent members very much ascribe to the realist theory of world politics. And for the Security Council to authorize any use of force that is not in self-defense, not only must 9 out of the 15 members vote in favor of it, but all 5 of the permanent members must either vote in favor or not vote at all. And permanent members of the council veto authorizations of force for all kinds of reasons having nothing to do with the justifiability of that particular use of force. We saw this happen with Kosovo, for example, when a resolution to authorize the use of force to stop the ethnic cleansing of Kosovar Albanians died in the Security Council. It didn't even come up for a vote because it was already known that 2 of the permanent members were going to veto it. Does that mean that that the Kosovo war was not justified? Well, I would say a strict constructionist legal scholar would say yes, but a just war theorist would probably say no. No, it doesn't mean that the war wasn't justified. All it means is that the realist politics of the Security Council got in the way of the Security Council being able to authorize this particular use of force. So this is a problem with treating the UN as an arbiter of the justifiability of force in moral terms. And I would submit it's also a problem in legal terms as well, but the path toward changing the law is a little easier than the path toward changing the morality, I suppose.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Kosovo here, and what I want to do now in our remaining minutes is toss out a few examples of wars and have you, JAG Davis or Academic Davis, put on your academic hat or your JAG hat and give us some evaluations of these different wars. Now, I'm not going to go through World War II. That's everybody's done that. World War I, you've kind of done that. So we're going to take a few here. And I want to first start with one that you had some involvement in, and that is the Iraq invasion of Kuwait. You mentioned you were in Operation Desert Fox, so you had a firsthand seat of this. So if I threw out the Iraq invasion of Kuwait, how would I interpret this in terms of just war theory?
Okay, well, that's the easy one. Iraq, being a member of the UN, actually being a state in the environment of customary international law today, had a duty not to invade and purport to annex neighboring states. And Iraq breached that duty, and in doing so, it caused damage to Kuwait. The damage was, one, the loss of Kuwait's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political dependence, independence, and two, the physical damage done by the Iraqi occupying forces, because the occupying forces committed all kinds of Indelo violations in Kuwait as well. So we clearly have a just cause. I would say using force to liberate Iraq from Kuwait met the criterion of proportionality, because the injury involved a large-scale use of military force. Therefore, it seems logical that the remedy would as well. Is it was the counter-invasion undertaken by proper authority? Yes. Not because the Security Council authorized it. That's not what proper authority is in just war theory. But because the counter-invasion was undertaken by states, the United States and the Gulf War Coalition. Was right intent satisfied? I think absolutely yes, because the United States stopped short of actually deposing Saddam Hussein or occupying Iraq itself. All the U.S. and the coalition did was to get Iraqi forces out of Kuwait and restore Kuwait's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence. So that's actually an easy case of war against Iraq being justified.
Okay, so let me toss out another one here and see if we can complicate things a little bit more. The Soviet Union used to be one big, huge amalgamation of countries, and then after 1991, it dissolved into a number of separate entities. And over the past 20 years or so, Russia has had some issues with some of its other countries and vice versa. So what about Russia versus Georgia? And I'm not talking about the United States Georgia, but the Georgia that is out there in Europe/Asia. And
Georgia's
Ukraine.
On John Lennon's mind.
Yeah. 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 And then also Russia and Ukraine, which has cropped up recently as well. How would we evaluate those situations in just war theory?
Okay. So, proper authority, well, Russia has met that because it's a state. That's actually not a hard one to meet. Just cause, okay, well, what legal wrong has been committed? So we live in an, and I'm speaking the way that Russia would, okay? I'm pretending to be Russia trying to justify their war effort. So we live in an era of human rights. So we live in an era of many multinational states, and it's widely understood that all citizens of all ethnic of all ethnicities and countries should have the same political and civil rights. Well, as I recall, with the Georgia case, Russia took the position that there was an ethnic minority in Georgia, and I think it was the Ossetians, though don't quote me on that one, but there was an ethnic minority in Georgia that was also an ethnic minority in Russia, and Russia wanted to be the champion of the civil and political rights of this particular ethnic minority. And Russia took the position that this ethnic minority in Russia did not have the same political and civil rights as Georgians or other ethnicities in Georgia. And Russia did the same with Ukraine, taking the position that ethnic Russians in Crimea and now in eastern Ukraine have not had the same civil and political rights, and also that, especially with the Ukraine case, that these ethnic Russians, they want to be in Russia, and they should be able to exercise their right of self-determination. As many other countries have done and been allowed to do. So Russia would be taking the position that the deprivation of the civil and political rights to ethnic Russians, ethnic Ossetians, or whatever other minority they were, that is a breach of a legal duty of states to give all people the same rights, regardless of ethnicity. So Russia jumped to the solution of going to war against these countries, invading Georgia, and invading the Ukraine and actually annexing Crimea. So that would be Russia's position. Now I'm going to put my just war theorist hat on and respond. Russia skipped a step. Russia has not demonstrated damages yet, and actually their argument of a just cause is shaky as well. Russia has to be able to show to the world that this ethnic minority in Georgia and the ethnic Russians in Ukraine really have been mistreated just in a terrible way, mistreated the way that people were mistreated under Idi Amin in Uganda or under Pol Pot in Cambodia, or mistreated the way that Saddam Hussein mistreated many in Iraq. And Russia was not able to do that. And because Russia was not able to do that, its claim of acting in humanitarian intervention on behalf of these minorities doesn't ring true. So I'm not prepared to say that Russia has met the criteria of just war theory in those two cases.
It really complicates things in this situation because as the Soviet Union, Moscow moved a lot of ethnic Russians into all these different territories. And when it dissolved, there's all these Russians hanging out in Georgia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan and such. And one could easily see how this can be manipulated into trying to justify the cause, because you could say, oh, these ethnic Russians that down there, they're protesting in the streets saying our rights are violated. Or maybe they even took a vote saying, oh boy, it's really hard being in Ukraine, being a Russian here. Does that have any say in it? Could there possibly be some Russians in a public opinion poll saying, boy, we're mistreated, Russia, could you come down here and take a chunk of land to save us or something?
If ethnic Russians really were doing that, then further inquiry, further investigation would be warranted to see the extent to which ethnic Russians really are being deprived of significant civil and political rights. But even if that were the case, I think we're going to find that if it's civil and political rights that are being deprived and not human rights, then we're less likely to find the messy and drastic solution of war to be justified. Many countries have had their periods of a minority being deprived of significant civil and political rights. Just look at the case of African Americans in the United States prior to, say, the 60s. And nobody thought of undertaking an intervention, a military intervention in the United States. But here's the other wrinkle. The dispersion of Russians throughout the Soviet Union, that took place in the imperial days, and it also took place during the Soviet days. But the people now living in the ethnic Russians in Ukraine now, the ethnic Ossetians in Georgia living now, they didn't ask to be there, but they're there now. So this idea of the Soviets maybe having created the problem by moving Russians into these areas, well, that doesn't work anymore. Because the people that are there now, I mean, they didn't choose to be born and raised in the locations that they were. So we can't beat Russia over the head for that now.
Okay. Complicating things even further. Let me go ahead and toss another one out. You mentioned Pol Pot a little while ago, so let me throw this one in. How about Vietnam's invasion of Cambodia in 1978?
Okay. So I take the position that war was actually justified, which is going to surprise a few people, people who know me and know that I am generally more sympathetic toward the position of the United States than otherwise. But this is an area where I'm not sympathetic to the position of the United States. Vietnam invades Cambodia primarily because Cambodian forces have been committing military incursions into Vietnamese territory. That's really how the war starts. Vietnam responds not just by securing its borders and degrading the Cambodian military's ability to invade Vietnam in the future. They go all the way. They march into the capital. They oust the Khmer Rouge from power. They do install a puppet communist regime. Cambodia does remain communist. It does not democratize. But the human rights situation after the fall from power of the Khmer Rouge was significantly better than it was under the Khmer Rouge. I take the position, along with a number of other scholars, that that if humanitarian intervention is justifiable at all, and I think it is, then the ouster of the Khmer Rouge was one of those cases. It may have not achieved the geopolitical result that the United States and other democracies would like to have seen, but it did put Cambodia in a better position than it was, the Cambodian people in a better position than it was before. So we'll go back to just war theory for a second. Proper authority, yes, because the invader is a state, Vietnam. Just cause, well, if an auto genocide is just cause, then that criterion is met. And I would say that an autogenocide is just cause for going to war in order to stop the autogenocide. Did Vietnam have the right intent? Well, that's a tougher question. That one kind of works against the Vietnamese. But because Cambodia's human rights situation did get better than it had been, or at least maybe less worse than it had been, I'm not prepared to say that that's a criterion that undermines the justice of the cause to oust the Khmer Rouge. So that's my take on it. I know there are scholars on both ends of ideologies that would disagree with me there, but that's my position.
So interesting take, and it also illustrates how this stuff can get somewhat murky in its interpretation. Let me try to stump you with one more, because this is one that is highly relevant to us folks up here in the Pacific Northwest, and that is the Pig War of 1859. I mean, everybody remembers the Pig War of 1859. I'm sure you do. It was a very intense conflict between the British and the United States over a series of waterways, straits here in the Puget Sound, and islands about who actually controlled what island. And the war, as I'm sure you all remember, started when a pig got loose and started eating up some vegetables or corn or roots of some other farmer that was an American farmer, and he accused this pig of coming in and eating up all his farmland on the San Juan Island, and shot the pig. And then the guy who had the pig was rather upset by this, and it gets militarized pretty quick, although no shots were fired. I think there was about 60 U.S. troops that were called in, including General Pickett from Civil War fame, Pickett's Charge. And the British occupied some of this territory as well. And the island, San Juan Island, remained occupied by both forces for about another two or three decades until some territorial dispute was actually determined. And the United States was able to retain possession of San Juan Island. And a little interesting tidbit for those of you out there listening to the show is that on San Juan Island, it's one of the places that the Union Jack, the British flag, is still hoisted every day. I guess that's part of the resolution there. So the Pig War of 1859, just war or not?
Okay. This may have been an intense conflict. I would say this was a particularly intense non-war.
Ah, yeah. No shots were fired other than the pig.
As you point out, no shots were fired other than the shot that killed the pig. Well, that was not an act of war. Because that was by a private citizen defending his property. So here's my take on the pig quote-unquote war. So Britain and the United States have a territorial dispute over the ownership of San Juan Island. From what I can tell, each side thought that genuinely and reasonably thought that it was the rightful owner of the island. This is not a case of a state making a clearly overreaching, disingenuous claim. Each state thought they were the rightful owner of the island. All right, so there are people living on the island. There are people who own property on the island. It's going to be remain to seen whether these people end up being residents of the United States or of British Columbia. We don't know at this point in time yet. So this incident happens, and the British authorities attempted to arrest the person who killed the pig. At that point, from the American perspective, you've got a case of a foreign country attempting to assert its sovereignty on a territory that is not theirs. The British are attempting to impose their sovereignty on territory that the United States believes belongs to it. And that is why then Captain Pickett was charged with with deploying a small force to the island in order to assert American sovereignty over the island. Without firing a shot, orders to defend themselves but not to fire the first shot. All right, so that's the American perspective. So far from the American perspective, I can't say that the Americans are acting unjustly. Now let's look at this from the British perspective. They also genuinely in good faith believe that Britain is the that British Columbia is the rightful owner of that island. So they see an American force deploying, trying to assert its sovereignty. So the Brits have to respond. Because if they don't, then in international law, if they allow this breach of its sovereignty to take place, and that breach goes on for too long, then in international law, the island might actually revert to the United States anyway, because the Brits will have been deemed to abandon the island. So they have to deploy forces too, and they deploy under the same order, under the same kind of orders. Use force to defend yourselves, but do not fire the first shot. I'm a little dismayed at reading that each side tried to taunt the other into starting the war, into starting an actual armed conflict. Fortunately, cool heads prevailed, and the democratic peace actually worked in this situation. I also understand that finally this dispute was submitted to arbitration, and the arbitrators found in favor of the United States, and the British withdrew peacefully and quietly, maybe not cheerfully, but they honored the decision of the arbitrator. So, by the way, the flying of the British flag, I don't know if that's a requirement. It may be done just as an act of grace, maybe an appreciation to the British for actually following the ruling of the arbitrator peacefully.
And it brings a lot of tourists to the island, too. You know, so.
So in terms of just war theory, we may have a case of what Francisco Victoria called invincible ignorance. And until reading about the Pig War, I had never seen a case where I thought the invincible ignorance was actually plausible. The principle of invincible ignorance says that it is possible for both sides of a conflict to genuinely, in good faith, believe its cause to be just. So what happens then? If the two sides get into a war, who is in the wrong and who is in the right. And that's a problem that is almost unresolvable, at least unresolvable until the key questions that nobody knows the answers to are actually answered. In this case, the key question was, whose island is this anyway? Whose territory is it? That isn't a question that got answered for decades, but when it finally did get answered, then at that point we had an answer to the justifiability of the conflict on both sides. And the objective answer is that the United States was in the right in deploying its forces to the island to assert its sovereignty, and Canada, well, Britain, was in the wrong in counter-deploying and in the wrong in trying to arrest the owner of the pig. Nobody could have known this in 1859, but objectively, we find this out decades later. So it's very fortunate that the two sides never actually got into an armed conflict, because had they done so, then and the arbitrator found found for the United States, Britain would then be liable to the United States for damages in its act of aggression against the American forces that were stationed on San Juan Island. That's what would have happened if the two countries had actually gotten into a war over San Juan Island.
Hmm. People don't understand that we were just on the brink of Armageddon there in 1859 over a pig that was eating potatoes. And it's just amazing. Actually, it has one of the best quotations, I think, in military history. Came from it. The farmer, I think his name was Cutler, on the American side, made his complaint. He said, the pig was eating my potatoes. And the British citizen, on the other hand, said, it is up to you to keep your potatoes out of my pig. I think that's just like one of the greatest lines in history. Somebody needs to make a bumper sticker of it.
Well, fortunately, neither of them were diplomats representing their states.
So let me finish up by asking you this question, and it's a question I ask of all my guests. It's kind of a self-reflection. You've had the opportunity to be an actual lawyer in the military as well as an academic studying this. And so your career has spanned a few decades here in wearing many different hats. What have you learned over the course of this, and how is it changing your mind about things and where we advance in the future?
What I've learned, especially after beginning my graduate studies in international relations, what I've learned is that despite the elegance of just war theory, despite the moral dimensions of it, which I think many states would like to see incorporated into the international system, despite all these things, the logic of realism is powerful. It is elegant in its own way. It is something that cannot be ignored. And unfortunately for us, it is a logic that too many states are still adhering to. I would say that is the biggest lesson that I have learned probably in the last 7-8 years or so. And this is not a happy lesson. Mearsheimer was right. Great power politics really is a tragedy. But it is the world we live in, and it's something that we have to deal with. How to deal with it? I would say the more states and the more diplomats that are willing to evaluate power politics through the lens of just war theory and do so in good faith, recognizing that occasionally they may be in the wrong, the more state leaders and diplomats that are willing to do this, the better. And I think the world could become a more just and peaceful place if that were to happen.
A lesson that we continually learn throughout the ages, and one that is certainly worth repeating. My guest today has been Davis Brown. Davis, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.